Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Jean Doe Massoero, who is an Alexander Technique teacher living in Montpellier, France. We've been doing a series of interviews about the influence of Francois Delsarte on F. Matthias Alexander, and we're going to continue that interview today. We're going to continue to talk a bit about the early period of Alexander's teaching primarily, and how Delsarte's ideas influenced that, and what Alexander did not have of Delsarte's ideas, and how that affected Alexander's approach to teaching as well. Jean Doe, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
Good evening. Yes. So if I could, what I'd like to do is very briefly recap a little of what we've covered and then go on for there. That we know we know for sure that Alexander held himself out as a teacher of the Delsarte method. I believe in Melbourne we have the advert and so on. And we know that Delsarte's younger brother was living in Tasmania and taught a lot of the people that Alexander, colleagues of Alexander, the Delsarte method, at least the Delsarte method of Camille Delsarte, Francois's younger brother, was very much in the air in theatrical circles, and that version of Delsarte was a sort of an early version of Delsarte. It didn't include one of Delsarte's methods of teaching that involved using illustrations. But as I've just learned from a preliminary chat with you, it did include directions of some sort. And I think it might be good to start with that. What directions would have been out there in Camille's teaching that Alexander would have known about?
Yes, I must make a comment.
Sure.
Because in fact, when Camille Delsarte left France, mm-hmm. it was a time when his brother was still teaching the gestural training. Mm-hmm. He abandoned that, and in his later life, because of the opposition and because of the fact that his pupils were using his gestural training to, in fact, compete in power with their voice, and he was appalled by this. Mm-hmm. But when Camille Delsarte arrived in Tasmania, it is quite sure that he had the whole gestural training system, which means that, contrary to what you just said, he had everything. He had the instructions, what we call orders or directions nowadays, but he also had the illustrations.
Oh, I didn't realize he had the
tableau.
I didn't realize he had the illustrations.
Yeah, because the tableau, we are quite sure that they were in full use around 1840. And Mr. Camille Delsarte left France in 1857, so he had the full thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that he transmitted it to all his pupils, and some of them, I'm not sure one of them was F.M. Alexander, but it's quite sure that Alexander, well, from what he wrote later on, it's quite sure that he knew the whole system.
Right.
So he decided not to use the designs, the illustration, the tableau, mm-hmm. but he knew about them.
So it does seem like it's not really likely that Camille Delsarte and Alexander actually met, because I believe Camille died in 1877.
Yes.
And Alexander would have been 8 years old at that point.
Yes, that's a bit too young.
A little too young. But his influence was definitely out there in theatrical circles. He was very well known, from what I understand, in theatrical circles in Australia.
Yes. He was absolutely famous.
And he did use the illustrations then for the gestural training. Is that right?
Yeah. But, yes.
Okay.
One thing is that he didn't have the knack of his brother, because his brother was able to draw you from at first sight and propose a different combination of movement of the part of your torso.
Mm-hmm.
But Camille had certainly examples of the, the picture his brother was using as a method of as a pedagogy.
So it's, but when Alexander started his own version of Del Sarte method, if you want to call it that, did he use those illustrations? Do we know if he did?
No, he didn't. There is no record ever, and he never talked about it. So, and none of his students have ever, had the impression or received such a training. So, no, Alexander did apparently not use them at all.
But he did, I believe, from what we've talked about earlier, he did take on or adapted or whatever Del Sarte's directions. Is that correct?
Yes.
He
adapted the idea of the Del Sarte directions, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, that grew out to be a problem later on, and that problem became, the solution of that problem became the hands-on solution.
And just to jump ahead, that problem was that the directions were really statements about what you wanted to achieve, not how to get to it. Was that the basic problem with them?
Yes, they were ends.
He was end gaining.
He was end gaining
of all people. Yeah, right. Okay. So, could you say? Could we then go into a little bit about Del Sarte and directions? Then to go back in time a bit to kind of what they were. What was their purpose? Yeah. What were they?
I think the best thing, I'm afraid it's going to be a bit lengthy, but the best thing would be to describe the Del Sarte discovery.
Okay.
The Del Sarte problem. Del Sarte lost his voice. He was a fantastic singer. He lost his voice through singing lessons he received in the Royal College of Music.
Uh-huh.
He couldn't sing anymore. The doctor said, you are not going to sing anymore. And what we know is that he felt pain in the larynx.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he was singing high notes.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's all this started because he started to find a better way to use the larynx.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was trying to sing in a way that did not cause pain.
Mm-hmm.
So when he started, it's very clear because he's written about this. He was following his sensory appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
The idea or the concept was the absence of pain should mean better functioning. That's how he started. Yeah.
Well, that was his initial assumption. If I can do something to reduce the amount of pain, it's probably a good thing.
Yes.
Oh, excellent. Uh-huh. Okay.
But then he discovered that it was wrong.
You're right.
wrong. Well, no, but it's very interesting. Yeah. You know, sometimes you have to go through difficulties in order to get to the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, the difference was that he had to change from what we call subjective work, according to what I feel this is better, according to what I feel this is painful. Yeah. So he went to what we call objective work. So objective work started because he noticed that his larynx was very highly placed.
Uh-huh.
So to notice that, you have to look at yourself in a mirror.
Okay. Good.
See?
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, we have no feeling of the movement of our larynx.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where our larynx is unless we look in a mirror.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was a musician, he drew a comparison with a brass instrument where you have a mouthpiece, that's a larynx, a tube, that's the pharynx, and the bell, that is the back of the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed that the distance from the mouthpiece, his larynx, to the bell, the back of the mouth, was very, very short. And out of that, He got a fantastic, what I call an intuition, because it's proven now by science. But at the time, I can't understand how he can write something like this, because he experienced a destructive shockwave, which is exactly what we should call it. Because when you've got a shortening of a mouse piece, is a narrowing of a passage of air, after that the air accelerates, and if the length of the tube behind the mouse piece is too small, then you get what we call a shock wave, which is a destructive impact on the system itself.
Yeah. This would be a shock wave going back towards the speaker's own throat?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So,
well, that's kind of basic physics, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes. Well, basic. No, I wouldn't say basic. It is physics.
It is physics.
It's not that basic.
Yeah.
Well, so there is also something else, is that he had teaching lessons, so he knew about the ideas at the time about the voice production. And there is one idea about voice production that was a scientific truth of the time, was peddled by every singing teachers. Peddled means is a discrimination there, because it's not true. But that as you sing higher notes, the larynx moves upwards. Yeah. If you try, if you see yourself in the mirror and you sing, you will notice that any untrained person, when singing, high notes will raise the larynx.
Right.
As a result, the larynx is constricted. Because the movement of the larynx, in fact, is a movement that is not for singing. It's a movement for deglutition, what we call swallowing. You know. And what happens is that the larynx has to move upwards when you swallow something, in order not for what you swallow to go into your lungs.
Okay.
So the restriction, the narrowing of the larynx is something of nature.
Right.
It's to prevent you from choking.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but his larynx was very high already. So every time he would sing high notes, he would go higher, it would become constricted, he would get a depression of the larynx, and he would suffer from it. So the problem he had is that it was a problem with the scientific truth, because he said, well, if the larynx moves upward to produce high notes, I am done. Because
he didn't have the scope for doing that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get the shock wave, because that's the way it is. So he didn't trust the scientific truth. He wanted to experiment to be sure. So that's how it started. That's how you understand that he had to go from subjective, how do I feel, to objective work, which is working with one or two mirrors. Yeah? So he started, and his point was to try to sing an ascending tune while lowering the larynx.
We
call that a conscious direction of a movement.
Right.
Yeah. So it's you have to be careful here, because it's quite something. It's an interesting movement to consider. Because if you try, so you go into in front of a mirror, and you sing something low, and then you go higher, and then your sensations are going to tell you that this is impossible. Your larynx has to move higher when you sing higher note. That's what, you know? And he didn't accept it. What he posits here is that maybe is a sensation where telling him the wrong thing.
In that he thought it was going higher when it was not going higher? Is that what you're saying?
No. It's much more complex than this. In the sense that when he was singing higher notes, he could see his larynx go higher. But he refused it. And he said, I'm going to try and modify this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to continue, because he wanted to save his voice, and he understood that there was no way he could save it if the larynx continued to move higher.
Right.
So he didn't accept the brutal fact of what he was seeing in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's when it becomes very interesting, because then you have to understand something. He has to inhibit what his feelings, what his sensations first have to tell him.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is a second point that he's making, and it's a making about something that is quite different from sensation. It is feelings, because his feelings were that he had to in fact lift his larynx in order to sing higher notes. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Come back to the same thing.
Right.
So he went on watching people, and he was watching their larynx all the time. You know,
yep.
He wanted to see when do people raise their larynx, and he discovered something. Well, apart from the fact that we lift the larynx every time we swallow or every time we vomit, he's quite clear about this. I didn't check, but I believe it's true, because otherwise the vomit will go into your lungs,
mm-hmm.
So the larynx has to raise. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But then he discovered something which we call psychophysical control. And it's very simple. He was watching a man lifting heavy luggage, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed that before bending and lifting each load, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The man would lift his larynx. But the larynx was lifted in proportion to the idea of weight the man had in his mind before trying to lift the box.
Right.
Yes, that's quite interesting, uh-huh. Which means that in accordance with the calculated effort, you raise your larynx. So he saw that, and he saw something else too that helped him quite a lot. He saw that when the man was calculating effort, he was moving his larynx up, and he was also shortening his torso.
Uh-huh.
There was not one move. There was related moves. So he straight away had the idea that if his idea of singing high notes was that it was difficult, he would raise his larynx. Yeah? And the higher mm-hmm. notes, the higher effort. So the higher he would raise his larynx. Mm-hmm. So he started to play a mental game with himself, telling himself that, no, it was not difficult.
Right, yeah.
It's a strange thing.
Yeah.
I've tried it in front of a mirror. I can tell you it's killing. It's like you wonder why he called this work. Well, because it's arduous work.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to create a mental instruction to generate simultaneous movements of different parts of the anatomical structure
mm-hmm.
That are contrary to what you feel, mm-hmm. contrary to what you sense.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, in the mirror, you could see that by the work he's done on his torso, he found a way to lower the larynx while he was singing higher notes. He had disproved a scientific law of the time. Well, I'm afraid that this law is still current nowadays, you know, because there are not many Del Sartes around to to do it.
And did he do that with a direction? Did he have a direction to do that with? Or was it force of will? What was going on there?
Well, he had to direct his will in a rational way.
Yeah.
This sentence is not from Del Sartre. It's directly from Alexander.
Right. Well, I mean, everything you've just talked about is almost out of the Alexander playbook, really. I mean, the idea of that guy lifting boxes and kind of predetermining what they're going to weigh and creating the necessary, what he believed to be the necessary tension to lift it, is exactly analogous to Alexander being on stage and thinking, well, hey, it's time for me to recite and get my voice out to the back of the auditorium. And as he discovered, as he says himself, he discovered pretty early that happened before the first sound was made. Wow. So Del Sarte was in a very similar situation to Alexander's.
Oh yeah,
And
it's so similar that at first.
it's almost like Alexander is Del Sarte Jr. here. I mean, it's amazing. And so Del Sarte, I think what I'd like to do is kind of end this little part of the story fairly soon and start another podcast to continue it. But to kind of cap it off, you're saying that Del Sarte did come up with a direction or directions that enabled him to avoid the shortening of his stature and the depression of his larynx, right?
Yes,
And
exactly.
that it was a bit of a struggle, but he did it, right? He succeeded.
Yes.
And I mean, that parallel, I mean, that takes us pretty much right up to what I mean, that's very, very similar to what Alexander his own story is up to a certain point. So maybe this would be a good place to bring this conversation to a close, and then our next podcast, which we're going to record in a minute or two, but is going to be what we're going to go on in Del Sarte's story and Alexander's story. So
Yes.
we'll close for now. My guest today has been Jean Do Masoero, an Alexander teacher in Montpellier, France. And Jean Do, thank you so much for this.
Well, you're welcome.